From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, we're commemorating the centenary of 1984 NEA jazz master, Max Roach, a titan in the world of jazz and a pioneering cultural activist. To mark the occasion, I spoke with two esteemed filmmakers, Sam Pollard and Ben Shapiro, who have co-directed the timely and frankly wonderful documentary, Max Roach, The Drum Also Waltzes. Let me tell you a little bit about the filmmakers. Ben Shapiro, a drummer himself, has an extensive background in both film and radio documentary, notably as a longtime producer for National Public Radio. Sam Pollard is a multi-award winner, editing, producing, and directing films about the African-American experience, such as Eyes on the Prize 2 or When the Levees Broke. And you may remember him from my 2015 conversation with him about his documentary, August Wilson, The Ground on Which I Stand. Well, both Sam and Ben bring their seasoned perspective on storytelling and cultural documentation to Max Roach, The Drum Also Waltzes. So in this centenary year of Max Roach, join us for this deep dive into the life of a musician who not only revolutionized music, but also stood as a powerful voice for social change. And in fact, that's where I began my conversation with Sam Pollard and Ben Shapiro, by asking them to place Max Roach in American music and in the struggle for civil rights. Here's Sam Pollard.
I think Max Roach is an icon in 20th century American music. First as a drummer, then as a composer, and then as a person who was able to bring into his orbit some phenomenal musicians, from Clifford Brown to Booker Little to Dee Dee Bridgewater to Charles Tolliver to Stanley Cowell, Gary Bartz, a phenomenal musician. So I think he is in the pantheon of great American musicians. That's how I would describe him. And in terms of Black consciousness, he became a major hero of mine because his notion of the importance of not just being a jazz musician, so-called, but being someone whose music was about engaging and challenging the American status quo of racism, he stood head and shoulders among us, being a musician who felt that he didn't just want to entertain, he wanted to be an activist, and he wanted to be involved in challenging what it meant to be an American and what it meant to be an African-American in this country.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, I think Sam put it well. The only thing I might add is kind of more specifically in terms of as a drummer, I think, I mean, clearly, as Sam said, he was a central figure in 20th century American music. But even more particularly, if you look at drumming and the history of drumming, he was one of those very rare examples. I mean, it's hard to think of other examples of instrumentalists on any instrument who have had such a singular impact just on how the instrument is used, how the instrument is played. And so I think that's something that's worth emphasizing. In terms of Black consciousness, I mean, when we were making the film, we were very aware too of the relationship of Max's work as an activist artist, as it relates to social movements of today. And I think saw him also as a role model in that regard, even for current times. So even though we can look at him as a historical figure, the way he applied his art, the way he expressed his concerns around social movements in his art, remains a model today, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, his politics are as much of today as his music is. Sam, how did this film begin with you? I know you, both of you, have had a long life with this film. So how did this film begin with you?
Back in 1983, I was editing the documentary about the poet Langston Hughes. And the director of that film, the late Sinclair Bourne, had did a sequence where Max Roach was performing a drum solo to one of Langston's poems. And I cut that sequence and I said to the saint afterward, man, Max Roach is phenomenal. Somebody should make a film about Max. And he turned to me and said, man, you should. And I was stunned. I said, me? I never directed before. I'm just an editor. But he said, man, you should make a film about Roach. So he paired me with our associate producer on that film, a woman named Dolores Elliott. And he introduced us to Max, and we pitched the idea to Max, and he was on board with it. And then we raised some money. And in 1986, 87, we shot our first session with Max, a long interview at his apartment on Central Park West, 100th Street in Central Park West. And then a few days later, or a week later, I don't remember now exactly, we shot a session with him doing a rehearsal session with his group and Boom, his percussion ensemble. And then we were able to raise some money from his record label. And we went to Milan, Italy, where he was doing a concert with the woodwind and string ensemble. And then I cut some material together and I looked at the cut after about, I guess it was 1988, 89. And I thought it was horrible, absolutely horrible. And the big mistake was I showed it to Max and he sort of didn't say yay or nay. And that sort of really stumped me. And I put it away and I would take it out every few years, look at it, make changes, look at it, hate it, put it away, shoot some additional interviews, put them in, look at it, put it away. And almost 20 years went by. And then Ben Shapiro, who I knew, you know, we got together one day and he said, man, let me see this footage you got of Max, because he had been a drummer. I'll let him tell you that part of the story.
Okay, take it away, Ben.
Yeah, well, when I was a teenager, I got interested in learning how to play the drums. And I was actually very lucky that I got to take lessons with a guy named Craig Woodson, who was at that point giving lessons, drum lessons, to support his work. He was studying to get a PhD in ethnomusicology, but he was studying drums and drummers and drumming and doing transcripts of Max Roach and Tony Williams and all these people. And he introduced me to drummers, but he always said that Max was the seminal figure. Just that's how important Max was. And so that stayed with me. And then I also, the more I learned about Max Roach, the more I also learned about his composing, the different bands he did, the Freedom Now Suite, the other music in the 60s. And so I just recognized that he was a fascinating and important figure. I've always had a kind of dual career where I work in film documentary, film and television, and also in radio. I produce for National Public Radio. And around 1989, when unbeknownst to me, Sam was filming Max, I managed to get a project going, doing a half-hour audio documentary for NPR about Max. And I went to his apartment, and he was very generous with his time, and we spent hours, probably about 5-6 hours over the course of 2 days, recording these long audio interviews, where basically he told me his life story. And so I produced this program and put that material away and held on to it. And then Sam and I became friends later, and I knew that he had worked on his film, and I suggested we combine our material, and then we started working on completing this film.
So for both of you, how did your individual filmmaking styles and experiences sort of complement each other in the making of this documentary? What were you each bringing to the table as you put this film together? And Ben, I'll throw it back to you and then to you, Sam.
It was a very, you know, complementary co-directing relationship. I mean, I've done that before and we worked well together, and I'll see if Sam agrees. Yeah, I mean, I think we both felt similarly about what the film needed to cover, what it needed to be, and we, you know, just kind of brought our own focus to it. I was a cinematographer for the interviews. I mean, that was helpful, I think, in terms of the film, getting it started. You know, before we had raised any money, we were able to do some of the important interviews because I own the equipment, and we just kind of went out and did them. Yeah, we just both applied our interests and focused on making the film that we thought we should make.
Okay, Sam, and what about for you?
I have to say that Mr. Shapiro and I'm in complete agreement with him. We got along really well. It was very collaborative. We know we would get together every week at a little coffee shop, you know.
Yeah.
We'd get together and talk about who should we interview, put together a list of names. Should we go to the Smithsonian to get this material? When do you have time? You know, who's going to be this person that we're going to interview? And except for maybe 2 or 3 interviews, we did them together. As Ben said, he shot and did sound, and I usually did the interviews, you know, and it worked out well. I think one of our first interviews was with Sonny Rollins.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, Sonny Rollins. And then we went on and did D.D. Bridgewater in New Orleans, and we did Jimmy Heath in Queens, and we did Randy Weston in Brooklyn. Ben went out to California and did Darryl Roach, one of Max's children. Then we did the other children here in New York together. So it was a really easy collaboration. And you know, in the editing process, we had a wonderful editor, Russell Green. He might have felt a little challenged because he's had to deal with 2 directors, but I don't think we didn't beat him up too badly. You know, so I think it was a great collaboration, you know, and I have to tell you, you know, I'm very proud of this film. I mean, every time I see it, and I don't watch my stuff as much as I've been watching this one. I'm very proud of it, and I'm excited that it really has captured people, you know, and people have really sort of taken to it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, though. I think we both were so excited just about doing it. And even when we went to the Library of Congress and looked through the archives there, that was just exciting. And like, we were eager to find things. And so that was part of it, too, just our enthusiasm. But also, I also want to add, you know, I mean, when you get to work with Sam Pollard, I always feel like that's a great opportunity. He's so experienced and so sophisticated in his understanding of the process of making films, and that I always knew when we work on the film together that I could rely on what his input in terms of process, in terms of what the film was like. So I always felt like that was a gift for me. I always welcomed that as part of the situation of making the film.
Well, I want to talk about the process of making the film, because you had a lot of archival material going into it. But then, as you said, you did any number of interviews. And that's my question, because Max Roach had a mighty reach. I am fortunate enough to be able to speak with a lot of great, great jazz musicians. And I can tell you, I always expect at least one of the following three names to be cited as their greatest influences: the organization AACM, Art Blakey, or Max Roach, about profound influences, not only about their impact on them as musicians, but as people. So how did you select the interviewees for the documentary?
Well, we wanted to make sure that we found musicians who knew Max or performed with Max or was in his orbit. And that was important. We had this discussion a lot. Should we have scholars, you know, jazz historians talking about Max and bebop and the 50s, that period in the 60s. But we knew we wanted to have, you know, musicians who knew Max, you know, who understood who Max Roach was. So that led us to people like Randy Weston, who grew up with Max in Brooklyn. That led us to Jimmy Heath, who performed with Max in the 50s. That led us to Tootie Heath, who was a drummer. That led us to Dee Dee Bridgewater, who had performed with Max. So we were pretty aware that it had to be musicians, because to me it would make it more intimate and more personal. I guess the only musical historian we talked to for the film, and I think he did know Max, was Greg Tate, the late Greg Tate, which was great. And then, you know, we threw in Questlove because he was a drummer and he had loved Max growing up. So, but most of the people we interviewed were musicians who knew Max personally.
I mean, Greg Tate was also at a couple of his key performances, right? So he could talk about seeing him directly and being at some historic moments in his career. So yeah, pretty much everybody in the movie, you know, talks about things that they experienced firsthand, which, as Sam said, was something we felt was important.
There is so much to Max Roach, his life as a musician, as a person, as an activist. It's so hard to get your arms around. But you make it clear from the first frame that you were going to explore and present him both as an artist and as a political figure. So we knew this is what it was going to be going in. Walk me through that decision and how that ended up framing the film, which I think it did.
Well, you know, we went around and around on how to open this film. I mean, we had a bunch of different versions about opening this film. One of the versions we opened up with Max passing away, that the sequence at the very end with Maya Angelou. Another version we opened with Max, we used an excerpt from Freedom Now Suite. We had a lot of different versions, but we always knew that it was important at the very beginning, as we started to go through all these different editing iterations, that we put up front that Max was not just a jazz musician. You know, he was an activist. You know, he was a person who was about doing more than just entertaining. So that was really important for us to do that as we were shaping the story. So, you know, like all filmmaking, it was a back and forth in the process, you know. I mean, one opening we had Max, another shot that's at the end with Max has got his drumstick up and he comes down, he starts playing a drum solo. That was another opening. I think we had like six or seven openings before we decided on this one. You know, it wasn't easy. And the other big thing that we did that we hadn't even considered initially was that introduction with me and Ben at the Library of Congress, going through the archive with my voiceover. Michael Cantor, the executive producer of American Masters, had seen an earlier version without that, and he had suggested, you guys should really give them a sense of the history of this project, the context. And initially, Ben and I were reluctant, you know, because I don't really like to put myself in these documentaries. But then as we talked about it over and over and over again, we decided, okay, let's try it. And we had shot the footage at the Library of Congress because of just that. Ben had brought the camera and said, maybe we will never know if we'll use it, but let's shoot it. And we shot it. It turned out to be invaluable.
Yeah, that was surprising, breaking the fourth wall. Yeah. That's very unusual for you, Sam.
Oh, I know. Really, I rarely do it. But this time, I think it works.
Yeah, I think it does, too.
Yeah.
Ben, would you like to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we both felt that we wanted to do a full biography of someone. I mean, a lot of jazz historiography and jazz music histories are about, you know, this person played this and they played that, and then the next person took it to the next musical level. They did this, but we really wanted to do a full portrait of Max as a human being, you know, as a musician, as an activist, and that was kind of our focus. That was one of the reasons why we made that particular choice to really give him the fullest dimension.
Well, he was one of the creators of bebop, playing with Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, but maybe because he was a drummer, not really given the props that others get. Talk about his role as a drummer and how he changed not just drumming, but the way we think about drumming and the sounds drums can produce. And I'll throw that to you, Ben, first, since you're the drummer.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd answer that in certain ways. I mean, certainly you can look at that group of musicians in the 1940s that developed this music that was called bebop or modern jazz. Max played a key part in that, in developing that, and also a key part in shifting the way that drums were played at that point from the way that they were played previously, like in the 1930s. I mean, one of the big things was moving the timekeeping element to playing rhythm on a cymbal, on a ride cymbal. He was one of the drummers who was important in doing that. But I think there's something larger about him, which is he had this vision, as he talks about in the movie, that you could look at drumming and percussion as being involved with the world of sound. And in which case, drumming and percussion becomes kind of limitless. It can be on a wide range of instruments. It can be using instruments different ways. And so I think that kind of sense of open possibility was something else that he contributed that was very important in drumming. And also, I mean, obviously, we can see that played out in his career over the course of all the different explorations he did. I mean, he not only said that, he was a model of doing that by this constant musical reinvention and exploration through all these different musical forms over the course of 5-6 decades.
Sam, do you want to add anything?
Ben said it all. I mean, listen, here was the time when drummers in the 30s, they were playing basically on the bass drum to keep the time. And along comes the Max Roach and the Kenny Clarke, and they used the ride cymbal to keep the time. And that immediately lifted this level of the drumming and the tempo of the drumming for groups like with Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Al Haig and, you know, all these musicians who were a part of that bebop movement. But then the thing about Max that makes him so special is that every decade he was evolving as a drummer. He wasn't just going to be a drummer that kept time. So when he started his own group in the 50s, the seminal group with Harold Land and Clifford Brown and Richie Powell, and then switching over from Harold to Sonny Rollins, that was another change musically in terms of Max. And then in the late 50s, early 50s, he decides that the drum should not just be a timekeeping instrument. It should be a solo instrument, which it was. He became a soloist, you know, where he knew that he could go on the stage just with his drum kit and create a whole set of musical performances without anyone else. And that sort of took him into a whole new direction. And Ben's right. His notion was about developing sound. Drums as a place to enrich this notion of musical sound, which he did. And one of the reasons that he brought together M-Boom was to bring together all these beautiful percussionists, not just drummers, who could play a variety of percussion instruments to create different textures and moods and feelings just on percussion instruments. Phenomenal. And here he moves on and he creates what's called the double quartet, where he has his daughter and these other string players, cello and violin and viola, playing alongside his quartet, which had Cecil Bridgewater or Billy Harper. You know, so he was always thinking ahead, you know. And then he's doing duos with Cecil Taylor or Archie Shepp or Abdullah Ibrahim or even with Dizzy Gillespie. This guy was never sitting, resting on his laurels, which makes him such a special, special percussionist.
One collaboration that you do focus on in the film is Max's partnership with Clifford Brown. He's a brilliant, brilliant musician, died way too young and is too little known. Can you explain who he was in Max's life and something about the depth of that collaboration? Because it's so important. And the music they created is still phenomenal, phenomenal music.
One thing that I think was important about Max's collaboration with Clifford Brown was that it was really the first time, I think, that Max was able to articulate his vision about how a group would sound. And of course, that involved bringing the drums more up front. You know, the drums play a central role in that band in a way that maybe even in earlier bands that the drums weren't so up front, weren't so central that way. But also, I mean, look, Clifford Brown was, you have to look at someone like that and recognize that he was a supremely gifted musician, the kind that comes along, you know, a few times in a century, really, on a particular instrument. And he still recognized as such, even though he died, you know, when he was just 26. And so having someone like that to help articulate Max's vision, someone who, you know, shared, you know, his level of proficiency and genius, and to be able to collaborate closely with someone like that. I mean, my sense is from listening to the recordings and from the way he talked about it, that it was a unique and special collaboration.
Yeah, you know, I would just add that, you know, listen to those compositions. I mean, these guys were at the top of their musical game. You know, there was a range of musical expertise and subtlety that they brought to each composition they played on those albums. And then, you know, they had a wonderful tenor player in Harold Land, and then even a greater tenor player when Sonny came on. You know, so they are phenomenal musicians. And you're right that you can still listen to his music and it feels very contemporary. It feels very strong even now. What can you say about Clifford Brown and Max Roach? That group will live way beyond Mr. Shapiro and Mr. Pollard.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting. That's an interesting point, too, about, you know, the works that don't age. You know, works that are timeless. It's a very special category. It's rare, but it's, you know, you sure can recognize it when you hear it, you know, and we could go down the list and we could talk about it. What are the other examples of that? But this certainly is one.
How did Clifford Brown's tragic death affect Max both personally and professionally?
Well, as we say in the film, it was devastating for Max to have to the loss of Clifford Brown. It's just absolutely devastating. And he went into as his family says, he went into a dark hole for a number of years. But, you know, he was able to regroup on a musical level, and he put together some very interesting bands. I mean, his Deeds Not Words band, you know, with Ray Draper and George Coleman, was a pretty damn good band. I mean, then the bands he had with Booker Little was a member of them, was great. He was always out there. I mean, so he kept playing and performing, even when he was going through all this sort of psychological and emotional turmoil on a personal level. And remember, you know, by early 60s, he did the Freedom Now Suite, which was seminal. I mean, he met Abby Lincoln. They fell in love. And she was a phenomenal performer herself. And then to collaborate on the Freedom Now Suite, whoa, brother, that's like when you just watch that footage, I still get chills. You know, watching Max with Clifford Jordan, you know, I think it's Coleridge Perkins on piano. It's just fantastic to listen to these musicians play that music. And that music is revolutionary. Every composition, the hairs on the back of my neck, you know, they rise every time I listen to it.
I wonder if you can talk about how the Freedom Now Suite was conceived and also the impact it had, not just on the music world, but on the movement, both here and in South Africa.
My understanding is Freedom Now Suite was actually originally commissioned by the NAACP, and it was initially performed at a conference, I believe. But, you know, I mean, Max had by that time already made the decision that all the, his music was going to be connected to the civil rights movement, for movement for social change. And so he brought that sense to this work. Abdullah Ibrahim talks in the movie about the impact of the Free of Now suite and Max's music of the 60s on the movement there, and activism there, and how much it was an inspiration to him and to others in South Africa, that they knew that someone like Max Roach was paying attention to their struggle, and that that was very important to them. And that was also recognized by the South African regime at the time, which, as they describe in the film, and so the record was banned and other records by American musicians that had the word freedom in the title were banned at the same time.
I'd love to have you talk just a little bit more about Abby Lincoln and the significance of Max's marriage to Abby, because she was a significant artist in her own right with her own artistic vision. And how do you see, and how do you discuss in the film, their careers intersecting and influencing one another?
Well, he meets Abby in the mid to late 50s, and she was then a classic sort of slash jazz pop singer. She had been in one movie, and she was being set up to become a pop diva in the sort of the same kind of ilk as Nancy Wilson did that later on in her career. And Max met her and told her, you don't have to do that. You don't have to be just a sort of this pop singer with these tight-fitting dresses. You have more talent than that. And she was an amazing performer. I mean, she was not only a wonderful, wonderful singer, but she was a phenomenal actor. I remember seeing her in Nothing But a Man in 1964. She was a very talented, talented lady. And if you look at the arc of her career after she left Max, she created a great body of work and albums that really are phenomenal, also fantastic music. You know, as I was trying to get people to interview for this film, I reached out to Abby in 1988 or 87. I took her out to dinner to try to persuade her to do an interview about Max, and she turned me down. I was probably just excited that she said yes to me taking her to dinner. You know, she was a great, great musician. Great musician. Listen to her singing Driver Man on Freedom Now Suite. Listen to her during the Tears for Johannesburg or Freedom Day. She had the chops to do some great stuff musically, which she did.
Max, meanwhile, is having some issues getting work because he didn't just want to play music. He wanted to put his music into a context. He talked to the audience about where it came from, and promoters did not like it. That had a fairly significant impact on his career, didn't it? And I'll throw that to you, Ben.
Well, it did. I mean, he was very committed to his politics, towards presenting certain things to audiences that he felt like they needed to hear. And that, in some ways, that put him at odds with club owners and presenters who wanted, you know, them to be just entertaining audiences, as they put it. And we should recognize that also impacted his recording career. He was recording for major labels in the mid 60s into the late 60s. He was on Atlantic for a while, and they dropped him after he started kind of focusing on this music that had these particular themes that were connected to the civil rights movement and movements for social change in the 60s. And so it definitely had an impact on him and his career. He mentions in the film even his ability to make a living was challenged. So I think that was difficult for him. At that point, he was able to get a teaching job at UMass Amherst and moved his family there, which enabled him to keep on doing the work that he was interested in doing without compromise.
Yeah, that was a very interesting, perhaps unexpected side note that happened when he went to Amherst, because he also found an artistic community there and other musicians and students and faculty that he could play with, have his ongoing band the way Charles Mingus did or Duke Ellington did. It could happen at Amherst.
That was sort of icing on the cake for Max. I mean, here he was, a renowned musician who was having trouble finding work in the clubs, but he was able to go teach it at Amherst and bring up some younger musicians, but also keep a working band off and on to do guest appearances. You know, so he was still productive, but he wasn't making the money that he had been making when he was just doing the club scene. But I think, being a former professor myself, I would assume that that experience also invigorated Max musically. You know, I mean, he put together vocal ensembles, he had percussion ensembles. I think it was also a good place for him to be because it kept him sharp. It kept his ears open and kept him wanting to connect with other musicians, younger musicians.
Well, the drum also waltzes has been widely praised. It premiered at South by Southwest, which is not exactly small potatoes. It's played in festivals not just in the U.S., but around the world. And it's part of PBS's American Masters series, and PBS aired it in October. But since 2024 is Max's centenary, I imagine the film is still going strong, and we'll be seeing it in theaters, community centers, libraries across the country. And I know it's showing in Newark at the Museum of Art on January 18th, and it's followed by a panel discussion, and you both are going to be taking part in it.
Yeah.
We're going to be in Newark, and then I think there's a screening of it going to be at Black Public Media in April.
There's going to be the Library of Congress, as you know. It's going to be at the Pan-African Film Festival LA in February, and the Vancouver, and screening at the Hot Docs Theater in Canada, and also in February. It's going to be in Spain. And also now it's also available as a rental on Amazon and on Apple TV.
But this is the kind of film that I honestly think, I mean, is certainly fine to see on your own, but is just begging to be seen as part of a community.
Oh, exactly.
To open up discussion,
I agree. I mean, that's why I'm looking forward to the screening in Newark. You know, I screened it at a festival here in the summer, and there was really great reaction to it. I agree completely. It's a wonderful film to see with an audience. And people have come up to me after the film and says, man, I remember hearing Max at this place or Max in that place. And it's just such a treasure to be able to share this film with so many people.
That's my final question. You know, it is Max's centenary, and I think the film plays a really important part of the story of Max Roach. And I wonder what you're hoping audiences will take away from The Drum Also Waltzes. And I'll go to you first, Ben, and then you, Sam.
So it's kind of a hard question for me because I think of him as such a multifaceted character and such a rich life in so many ways. I mean, I guess the one thing, well, several things. One is just the richness of his musical life over the course of his life. I hope people come away with that understanding of just what an extraordinary artist he was. And, you know, I think people recognize Max Roach or have often recognized him, you know, in kind of fragments. You know, in a funny way, I think there are people who are drummers who recognize certain things he's done on the drums. I think there are people who look at the Freedom Now Suite, and that's very important to them. There are people who look at him, Boom, and his later. But I think it's important to be able to look at him as the entirety of his career. And so I think that's what I'd like to take away from him. And also, it sounds kind of funny to say, but I'd like people to recognize him as a person. You know, it's very easy often with, you know, great artists and jazz musicians, they're mythologized in a certain way. And I guess I'd like the people in seeing this story that we've created, his arc of his life, kind of feel like they kind of understand him as a person, get to know him as an individual, you know, kind of empathize with the track of his life overall.
What I would say is this. To me, the important thing to take away from this film is that if you are a human being, no matter if you're a musician or a doctor or a janitor, you should stay open to the curiosities of life and never sort of lock yourself into just doing one thing or being one way. Stay curious, stay open, stay engaged. And that, to me, is why Max Roach is such a major, major hero for me, because he was always engaged. He was always curious. And as I said earlier in this interview, he never rested on his laurels. And that, to me, says all it can say about a human being like Maxwell Lemuel Roach.
And I think that is a great way to end this. Sam, Ben, thank you both so much. Thank you for making this absolutely terrific film.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Be good.
Thank you. You just heard from filmmakers Sam Pollard and Ben Shapiro. We were talking about their documentary, Max Roach, The Drum Also Waltzes. To find out where the film is showing, check out their website, maxroachfilm.com. And this I can tell you, if you're in the New Jersey area on January 18th, the film is being screened at the Newark Museum of Art, where the filmmakers will take part in a panel discussion. And then on January 26th, also in Newark, NJPAC, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, is presenting a performance of Max Roach's Freedom Now Suite. We'll have a link to it all in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.